think to yourself that we are engaged in the study of the Dharma this afternoon for that purpose, and please listen with this motivation of bodhicitta. And the Dharma that we are listening to is the the way of the Bodhisattva by Shantideva. So in our multi-year course, we are on the third year, sixth chapter. And within this sixth chapter, we last night had some general discussion about dealing with anger, and today we began in the morning with a discussion of the text. And a discussion of the text. What is there? There are basically the two main parts. There are of this chapter, there's thinking about the benefit or the results that anger brings as a way to inspire us to practice to do something about it, essentially, to practice the Dharma. And then the second part is the need to devote ourselves to the patience, which is so indispensable. And that second part has two parts, which is the six blocking the six reasons or the six reasons for anger, and then thinking about the results of patience. Within the results of patience, we are, within the blocking the six reasons for anger, the six ways of blocking anger, there is a teaching on the causes of anger, the fuel or sustenance for anger, the promise never, the commitment never to be free from joy, and then teaching the thoughts of what is thoughts of wishes or of desires, and what is desired and undesired, that are what we need to have patience for. And then we are in the question in this fifth section, which is overcoming our thoughts of displeasure at the undesired. And so we're in that bit. And this part has these sections about the three different types of the undesired things happening to ourselves and happening to our others, and then desired things, when good things happen, the displeasure we feel at good things happening for our enemies. And so for the first of these, we have basically three different types of patience. And these are the patience of accepting suffering, accepting pain and suffering, which we were discussing this morning, although I didn't clearly indicate the beginning of that topic. Then the second is the patience of contemplating the Dharma. And the third is the patience of disregarding harm. So the first of these is the patience of disregarding, or of the patience of accepting pain and hardship. And basically, this is really important because for a couple of reasons. The first of these reasons is that we're going to undergo hardship anyways, and especially if we're going to practice the path, we need to have a little bit of fortitude to be able to practice the path of meditation, even if we're doing it in a fairly benign way. Even if we don't go off and do long retreats, it still takes a lot of effort and time, and it's not always so easy to practice the path of meditation. So you have to have a certain amount of fortitude to be able to do that. You have to be able to put up with the difficulties that happen when you're doing it. If you want to, say, go for a pilgrimage in India or Nepal, you have to be willing to put up with a 32-hour flight. It could be worse. We could have to go on a boat for a long time and then walk for months to get there and risk the landmines and such on the way. It could be a lot worse than 32 hours, but somehow 32 hours seems like a really long. So you have to be able to be willing to put up with the uncomfort and the swelling feet and the bad food. At least they're giving you food, if you can call it that. But that's kind of a minor sort of difficulty. Then there are other difficulties that come up because of Dharma practice, problems that we have sometimes. There are various difficulties that you might encounter in your Dharma practice, and you have to be willing to have some fortitude to do it. And especially if you're going to practice intensively, like this last winter, when Drupin Kempo Thabo Rinpoche was speaking about this chapter in Varanasi. He went on at this for many days on end, as he's wont to do, and he has a lot to say. And he can be very strong. But when you're practicing, and if we really wanted to practice to the level that we would really be able to give some meaning to this life, you know, we'd probably be doing 8, 10, 12 hours of meditation a day if we really wanted to, if we really felt committed to it. Now, you don't have that commitment yet, because if you had that commitment, you might be over in the retreat center with Kempo Thabo already. But if even if we don't have that level of commitment now, we're kind of on the first steps on the path. There's still good that we can do, but we have to think about how much are we willing to do? How much are we willing to put up with to do it? There are going to be days when you're not feeling well, and yet you kind of need to be diligent and keep going. There's some pain involved in that. There's some difficulty. When you may have difficulty sitting for a long period of time, and you have to be able to bear with that. And if you can't bear with the pain of sitting for a couple hours, then the thought of really devoting yourself to, to achieving Buddhahood soon. I mean, because we're all here and we're all talking about it, from our Buddhist point of view, we've all made a connection, and it's certain that we will achieve Buddhahood. But it's a question of how many eons you'd like it to happen in. We'd rather a few eons or a few lifetimes. And that's up to us. So if we're going to be diligent in our practice, we have to be able to put the effort into it. We were talking at lunch, and you think about the inspiring stories of Milarepa. Well, what did Milarepa do? He first, he obviously had a lot of patience of accepting suffering to go through what Marpa put him through. And building four towers, building them, tearing three of them down, halfway built, and then building the fourth, having to tear that down and restart it for various reasons, and all the difficulties he went through just to even get the instructions. And then once he got the instructions, the difficulties that he went to in retreat. Not so much his first retreats when he was near Marpa. Those sound like they're pretty nice. He spent 11 months in a cave with a lamp on the top of his head, a lit lamp on the top of his head, so that he would know when he was getting a little bit off center in his meditation. So you've got the lamp right up there, you can't move. You just sit there doing meditation for 11 months. And then, he went off and after he left Marpa, he went to see his homeland, and then he went up to the foothold cave where he had some food. But then it was starting to get a little bit busy there, so he went up to Horse Tooth White Rock Cave, Takata Tassel, and spent over 12 years there, seeing no one, with only nettles to eat. And, he decided that he was going to be, like we say in the Kagyu tradition, a child of the mountains, wearing clothes as the mist, taking the loss in food, fame, and clothing, just not caring anything about this lifetime. And as a result, he was able to achieve the supreme result of Buddhahood in this lifetime. And, we still read his biography today. Why do we do that? Because he didn't get up there and after 6 months said, "I'm sick of nettles. I'd like a little bit more comfortable seat on my rock." He brought up some cloth or something. I don't remember the exact, or skin or something, and it wore out. So he had that drive and motivation. So if we want to have that sort of diligence in our Dharma practice, we have to start meditating, because you don't get there overnight. And I'm not expecting, as I said this morning, I'm not expecting any of you to go up and find the caves on Mount Katahdin and meditate there. It might be not be a bad idea to do a nice national park. Don't go up there in deer season, though. Maybe when you're in deer season, keep yourself in the cave. Don't go outside for a month. But But to do that, we have to get ourselves ready, and we have to train ourselves in being able to put up with the little bits of pain and suffering we experience now. Because as you get used to small pain and suffering, then your ability to put up with hardships and difficulties will go stronger and stronger and stronger. Kempo Habu likes to say that, I don't want to sound like I'm quoting him, but the way I understand him is like it's basically, Dharma practice may well mess up your life in some terms, if you really do it intensively. Especially if you're in the middle of a nice career, you get the Dharma bug, you throw it all away and you go off on a long retreat, your career is gone. If you go on a three-year retreat, very hard for a marriage to survive a three-year retreat if one goes and the other doesn't. If they both go in, you have to go into different places, otherwise it just doesn't work. And so you both go into retreat, and you never know what's going to happen at the end of 3 or 4 years. And so on a worldly level, what do you do to gain when you go into long retreat? Nothing. You spend all your savings. You have, or a large chunk of them, you've ruined your career, you've ruined your marriage, your children are probably angry at you for leaving for 4 years, so you've gained nothing on worldly terms by going on a three-year retreat. And even after the three-year retreat, what do you get in terms of the Dharma? You have a basic idea of how you do the practices, you still don't really know how to meditate. And the question of whether you really have changed your motivation is a very good one, because it takes a long time to do that. So, when we're practicing the Dharma, even if we're not really getting to the level of practice, think about some of the other lamas who've come who started out and did a lot of, or maybe a better example would be the examples of the nuns who go through and who go up in the mountains. They don't get as much support, they don't have as much thing, but they're up there in retreat, they practice, they get results out of their practice. It's inspiring to see them. Nowadays they get more support, but in the old days, nuns, they didn't get much. But they would go and practice, and the masters, a lot of masters would go and teach them up in the hills, and they would learn, and they'd be able to do practice and really get progress out of that. Now, on a worldly level, you look at it and you say they're discriminated against, they didn't get any education. When they're done with it, they don't get a title, and yet they get what's more important. They get the results. That's what's important. That's what we have to look for in our practice. In fact, if you're going through as a monk and you go through and you think, oh, I'm going to become a lama at the end, forget about it. If you're thinking at the end of my retreat, I'm going to become a lama, forget about having any real results out of your retreat. You're not going to get anywhere. If you want that title at the end of the retreat or at the end of your shudra, your motivation is poisoned. And because your motivation is poisoned, even if you're given that title, you're never going to really live up to it. It doesn't make any difference. The title is not important. In fact, it can be a real obstacle to the practice. So just feeling, I need to practice because this is the Dharma, this is my chance, I've got this lifetime, I've got to use it well. Come what may, no matter how difficult it is, I'm going to devote myself to this practice. That's what you need to do if you're going to be able to actually achieve long-lasting results out of Dharma practice. And you have to have, you have to have understanding, you have to have guidance, you have to have a good situation for doing that. And that's kind of what I think we try to create in these Dharma centers, although, frankly, none of us are really at that level yet to do it. But we try to do what we can to create an atmosphere where we'll be able to go on and do that. Yet we have to keep our focus on what's important. The temporary pains of this lifetime are temporary. It's like, And the results that we gain by having a good motivation and doing whatever we can now while we have this opportunity are great. If we think when we start out practicing the Dharma, when you start out in the four foundations, starting the four foundations, it's kind of like you start with your prostrations. Actually, you have to start with the four ordinary foundations, the contemplation, the precious human body, the impermanence, karmic cause and effect, the defects of samsara. And then to think, if you really take that precious human body to heart, you've got this chance now. We're born human. We've come into contact with the Dharma. We've come into contact with a lineage. Many of you have met great teachers. And we have this connection where we've got an authentic transmission of the Dharma down to us. And so at this point, we have this incredible opportunity. So we have to do what we can to use it now. Because the chances of it coming about again, if we do not do anything, are extremely slim. As Shantideva says, I've gained what is so difficult to get, the leisures and resources to benefit beings. If I do not accomplish good while here, when will I ever come to them again? Just as between the clouds on pitch black nights, lightning reveals the heavens for an instant. Thoughts for the merits of the world arise for a brief moment through the power of the Buddhas. It's a very short time that the thought for the merit of the world, that is the thought of making use of this life, making it meaningful, achieving enlightenment, becoming a Buddha, this thought happens just such a short time. We may look at it, we may think that this life is long, but it's not. It's very short. And it goes by quicker, and we don't even know when it's going to end. We don't know what's going to happen tomorrow, but we have this opportunity now, and we have to use it. And if we are kind of put off by, it's just too hard, then what's going to happen to us in the future? Where are we going to be next? So that's why it's so important for us now to develop this ability to put up with the difficulties we're going to face and to be able to work through them and to be able to devote ourselves to the Dharma. Now, devoting ourselves to the Dharma, and because you're all here in Portland, Maine, you're living here. Some of you are retired. Some of you are working. And if you're working, you haven't got a whole lot of time of your own. So you have to use the time that you have. We have to remember, think about what is really most important in this lifetime. Is it the worldly things that we want to do? I mean, here we are in this city, which is a nice-sized city. It's big enough that you've got lots of good places to get good food. There are lots of nice people. There are, you know, it's a comfortable place to live, except in the winter and in March and April. And the winter goes on for a while. But, you know, it's a pretty, pretty nice lifestyle. Some of you have come from further away, but not that far away. It's not that much different in eastern Massachusetts or wherever else you might have come from. We all have a pretty good place. We can get nice bread from nice bakeries. But how much bread do you have to eat to make a meaningful life? Making a really good bread. I mean, good bread is wonderful, of course. I'm not slagging bread it just happened to be what's coming in mind. Another year it might have been coffee. But, you know, when you're thinking about this, you know, the bakery or the donut places or whatever, all these things, these are things that if you're eating them, you're just eating what you've already earned. All it's going to do is become tomorrow. That's really. I mean, you'll be fed for a day and it's going to come out the other end. No matter how nice your drink is, it's going to come out yellow tomorrow. Or maybe not tomorrow. Might not have to wait that long. It's just, this is what our bodies do. It's what Shantideva calls in one of my favorite lines, or at least in my translation, a festering machine of filth. Where it's just anything that comes in, no matter how clean it is going to come out foul. It's the nature of it. And yet we spend so much time taking care of it. But what is this body good for? What can we do with this body? This body isn't good for anything of its own, except that we can use it to do something that will bring lasting benefit for ourselves and others. And that's Dharma practice. So we have to find a way to fit it into our lives. I mean, I'm not saying don't eat good bread. I'm not saying don't eat donuts from time to time. Be careful so you don't give yourself diabetes, but be fine about it. But I'm not going to say don't do it. But you have to keep it in perspective and think what's most important. And most of all, you really have to think about your motivation and what's important and what is really going to make this life meaningful, this short time that we have here, this short time of uncertain duration. How can we make it meaningful? What can you do in the context of your own life? You all have responsibilities. Some of you have people you have to look after, whether they're aged or young. You have situations that you have to take care of. You are in commitments with various people. And I mean, on a regular worldly level, just walking away and saying, I'm done with all that now, isn't going to work, and you aren't going to feel good if you do it. But what you can do now in this lifetime is you can really think hard about your motivation and devote yourself. Make sure that you take the time to do some Dharma practice every day. Do what you can. Have a good motivation. And make it so that that Dharma practice isn't just something else you do, but it becomes like a focus of what you want to do. Not exclusive focus yet, but something that you can think, this is important for me. I'm going to follow it. I'm going to do it. And as you do it, it'll grow. And at some point, you might come to the point in this lifetime when you are ready and you are going to say, I've done enough of this. I've had enough bread. I've had enough donuts. I've drunk enough coffee. I don't care about those anymore. I really want to devote myself full time to Dharma. And then you can go do it. But if you go and you were to say right now, I'm devoting myself full time to Dharma, before you have that strong motivation, it's going to be really difficult. So you have to work now to have that motivation. Understand what a precious opportunity we have, how short it is, and how uncertain. And even if it lasts a long time, the question of whether we're going to be able to use, how much of it we're actually going to be able to devote to Dharma practice. For myself now, at the age of 50, I figure I've probably got 15 to 20 years of a clear mind left, at best, unless I start going senile, and unless I die in the interim, which is, you know, not impossible. And even then, after that, then your mind just gets a little bit foggier and foggier. You start forgetting things. The body gets weaker and weaker. You can't do what you used to do. So now, while you have the time, the opportunity, the health, you have to take advantage of it. Whatever degree of health you have to use it well. And the most important thing is to think about that motivation. When you have a clear motivation and you know what your goal is, then you're going to be able to put up with the difficulties that come. It's like people who are in medical school. They start out medical school and residency. They start out with a clear idea. I want to help beings. I want to help beings. And they keep that clear idea in their mind at least 6 months, and then their motivation might change. So it's, I want to get that Porsche. I want to get that Porsche. But they've got something that they're looking forward to in this lifetime. Yes, two Porsches. And then they're, because they've got that goal in mind, I hope there aren't any doctors that I'm insulting here, but they've got that goal in mind. They're able to go through all the effort. And actually, even the ones who are thinking about Porsches are also still thinking about helping people. They think about, how are we going to be able to get through this? Because they've got a goal, something they want to do. Those for whom that goal isn't strong enough aren't able to make it. So if you work now at developing your motivation, thinking about those four thoughts that turn the mind, the precious human body, impermanence, karmic cause and effect, the defects of samsara, then you'll be able to put up with the pain and suffering. You'll be able to practice this type of patience of accepting pain, accepting suffering. And this is a really crucial quality for us in Dharma practice. So this is what we were talking about mostly this morning. And this section has quite a few, has about 10 verses. And we've come to the last of these verses, verse 21. Where am I? And I'm right at that kind of in-between spot, in between which pair of glasses I should be wearing. This is another problem of growing old. Now I have to change glasses when it's close. And anyways, yes, where are we? Make the letters big. So verse 21 reads, um, plus suffering has benefits. Weariness dispels arrogance. Compassion arises for the samsaric. Shunning misdeeds, you delight in virtue. So there's benefits, actually, when we experience suffering. It's not an entirely negative. We can take that suffering as a teacher. It's not a teacher. It's not the teacher we choose, first of all, if we had the opportunity, but we don't. It's the nature of our lives, the nature of samsara, that we're going to experience suffering. So when that suffering occurs, then we can develop weariness, world weariness. This is the weariness with samsara, the disillusionment or weariness. And when you feel that weariness with samsara, then that eliminates any arrogance, feeling full of yourself. I'm good at this, I'm good at that, and you just feel like you're sick of samsara. Then that deflates your arrogance. Compassion arises for the samsaric. If we never experienced suffering ourselves, we would never be able to have any sympathy for others. Because it's through understanding, you understand how it feels to suffer. You understand what it's like to be sick on some level. Maybe there are certain illnesses that we can't understand. Everyone's illness is particular. And to say, oh, I understand what it's like to have diabetes because I've had a common cold would be ludicrous. But the idea of understanding that we don't want it. When you have a flu or a cold, you don't want it. You want to do everything you can to do it. Understanding that helps you understand other people. When you experience pain and suffering of your own, then you can take that as an example. Just as I don't want this pain and suffering, other beings do not want it either. So we, as the Buddha said, use your own body as an example to understand the suffering of others, to develop compassion. We take the body as an example, take our own suffering and our own difficulties. We use that so we can understand others. You can even do this in terms of thinking about it on a kind of hypothetical level. Boy, if I were in that position, how would I feel? And really thinking about it. Because sometimes we just don't really put ourselves in other people's position. We just kind of ignore it. But when you take the time and you look and you think, I've experienced suffering, but not like that. What are they going through? And you think about the pictures of migrants in detention, people in Syria, the Kurds in northern Syria. Syria has been a source of many such examples for the last decade or so, 8 years. Thinking about all those suffering beings. When you see people who have their lives have been destroyed closer to home, their lives have been destroyed by opiates, and you look at the suffering that they have. There are people whose lives have been destroyed by someone else having problems with opiates. These are the problems we see. Some of you know these problems. And when you look at that and you think, if that were me, what it would be like? It's because you have an understanding of your own suffering that you can then understand their suffering, and then you realize you can't bear your own suffering, and neither can they bear their own. And then from that, you develop the compassion. I have to do something to help them. I have to do something to benefit. Sometimes when you have that compassion, there's something we can actually do. Sometimes there's not. Sometimes it's just like there's no way to help that other person directly right now. And when that happens, then we have to do what we can to develop the qualities to be able to, which means achieving Buddhahood, achieving wisdom, developing that qualities that will actually be able to benefit people. And we make the aspiration, I cannot help that specific being right now. In the future, may I be able to help these beings. Whatever your prayer is to help beings who are suffering from detention, war, addiction, all the other social ills, whatever problem it is that you see and you feel like, I can't do anything, you can do something. You can make the aspiration, may I be able to help them in the future, and you can do what you can to follow the path so that you will. And those two together will eventually put you in a position where in some lifetime, in some way in the future, you will be able to help. But it takes a while. So that's the suffering has benefits. Compassion arises for the samsaric, and shunning misdeeds, you delight in virtue. This last line assumes that you really accept karmic cause and effect. You realize that the suffering that you're experiencing now, the difficulties, the problems, the minor difficulties, the greater difficulties, many of them arise from samsara, or from karma, in particular from our bad karma, the misdeeds we have done in the past. And when we think about, I don't want to experience that in the future, if you really take the teachings of karmic cause and effect to heart, then you think, I don't want to experience this ever again. Therefore, I must avoid the things that are the causes. That's misdeeds. Now, suffering, we have to be a little bit clear here. Suffering, when you talk about karmic cause and effect, misdeeds are the cause of an unpleasant result. This is in terms of karmic ripening. And so this is not looking, you can do a misdeed and get a temporary result that is good. You steal $1 million and then you can buy yourself lots of nice things. You've done a misdeed and it looks like you've got a good result out of it. But that's not the karmic result. So what we're talking about is you've planted a seed in your mind of doing something bad. And then as your mind, when your mind and body part, then at some point that seed is going to ripen as an appearance in some future time. It might even ripen in this lifetime, frankly. That'll be an appearance of something bad happening to you. That's the way the teachings on karmic cause and effect phrase it. But this is something you have to really think about it. And again, because as I was speaking about this morning, we don't really have trouble accepting past and future lives. And if we don't accept past and future lives, accepting karmic cause and effect is very difficult, especially since karmic cause and effect is a complex thing. So you really have to consider them. Trungpa Rinpoche often talks about it. If you study texts such as the Abhidharma or other texts, and there's also a book by Trollope Kyapkin, the previous Trollope Rinpoche, about karma, cause, and effect that you might find helpful to look at, or you can discuss it in your study group. I don't think we have too much time to digress about it much, but really thinking about it. And in particular, if you are doing the preliminary practices, you really need to start thinking about it. How does it work? What do I see about it? How does it happen? Why does one person end up in a fortunate position and the other person not? What are the causes? How is it that I was born in, for myself, how is it that I was born into a situation of relative, not huge, but relative prosperity with pretty much every advantage you could have in an affluent society? Why was I not born in another position? What did that come from? And I can't pinpoint the causes exactly, but the only one that really makes sense to me is karmic cause and effect, that it must have been something. Because you can see, when you do something good, what does that do to your mind? When you do something bad, what does that do to your mind? Then think about, how is that going to manifest itself in the future? That's what we're talking about. So you need to think about that. When you really take it to heart, then the idea of doing a misdeed is just like, you wouldn't do that. Why would I do something that's going to cause suffering in the future? But that means that you really, really take it to heart and that you're not just thinking about the short term of this lifetime. We really have to think about the future. So that's the end of the section on the first type of patience, the patience of accepting pain and suffering. And it's kind of the basis, as Drupin Kempo Labu taught last year. The basis for the other two types of patience, the patience of contemplating the Dharma and the patience of disregarding harm. So next we come to the second type of patience, which is the patience of contemplating the Dharma. And this has four parts. And the first section is talking about how the other person has no control because they're under the control of the afflictions. Other people aren't in control of themselves. They aren't able to prevent themselves from doing harm. So when someone does something that harms you, we usually think that that other person made a conscious decision to do something to harm you. That they decided, I'm going to harm you, and that they had agency in this. They were able to do it. They were able to decide to do it. And this is the way we talk about it and look at it in worldly terms. But having agency, if you're really going to have agency, you have to have control over your mind. And honestly, look at yourself. how much control do you have over your own mind? And I look at myself and I find I don't have a lot of control over my own mind. I'm in a situation where I know, oh, I'm going to get angry if I'm not careful, and I end up getting angry, even though I think, because I don't have control over my mind. And so other sentient beings are the same. Are we able to resist our impulses? And if we're not able to resist our impulses, other people aren't going to be able to resist their impulses either. So that's what we're basically talking about. We think that people are in control, and we think that it's right to get angry at them because they're in control. But when we look at it on a deeper level, we see that they're acting because of causes and conditions that if they were cognizant of and had more prajna, had more ability, more discernment, intelligence, they would be able to control themselves. But they lack that. And because they lack that, they don't have control. And so this is what we start out with in verse 22. And it starts with an example, medical example. We don't get angry at bile and such great sources of suffering. So why be angry at the sentient conditions provoke them too? So here, bile and so forth means bile, phlegm, and wind. The causes of illness according to Ayurveda, Tibetan medicine, I think it's related to Chinese medicine as well. We've got, and when these get out of balance, then you have, and also actually medieval medicine, I'm not sure if that's an advertisement, but when the bile, phlegm, and wind get out of balance, then you get different illnesses that can occur. And so it actually can get pretty subtle and complicated when you look at it. But when we get angry, when we get sick, do we get angry at our bile, phlegm, or wind, or do we get angry at the microbes? For example, if you get the common cold or the flu, are you going to get angry at the virus? Bad virus. There's no point, because the virus is just acting mechanically so far as we know. If you come down with a congenital disease, are you going to say, bad genes, I'm angry at my genes? Well, sometimes people do, actually. They do get angry at them. I'm not going to discount that, but it doesn't do much, and you can't do anything back. You can't retaliate against your genes. You can't retaliate against a virus. You can retaliate against bacteria, and we do. We take medicine. I got the cold. We don't think those horrible bacteria that gave me the cold, right? So just as we don't get angry at the causes of illness, why should we get angry at sentient beings who harm us? Because just like the illness, they are acting because of conditions. People are put into sentient beings are put into positions where they're going to, where they feel like they have no choice. They see that the only reasonable course of action is to do something that's going to cause you harm. They think they're acting reasonably, otherwise they wouldn't, or they think they're going to be able to get away with it. They're impelled by their greed, their hatred, their pride, their envy, whatever it is, and they do something that then harms you. Whether it's physical or whether it is speaking in terms of words. Here in this context, we're talking about it in terms of physical harm. So sentient beings who harm you are compelled by the situations that they find themselves in, and they don't have a lot of agency in the matter. So then we might think, well, we could get angry at the afflictions. And as it says in verse 23, just as such illnesses occur involuntarily, afflictions are compelled to rise involuntarily. So the common cold, the bacteria for the common cold, assuming that it's not sentient, we're not certain if it's sentient or not, but if we're assuming that it's not sentient, it's a material thing that just happens to fly through the air and get into your body and cause certain reactions. It doesn't have any will. Even if it were sentient, I don't know how much control a bacteria has over its life cycle. I mean, it can determine how much, I suppose they can decide whether to reproduce or not. Let's do some mitosis now. I don't know. But other than that, I don't know how much agency a bacteria actually has. So just as the illnesses happen because of that, they don't have any choice but arise. It's because of certain conditions coming together that the illness occurs. Likewise, the other person cannot help but feel the afflictions when the certain things come together. Something that they either desire or dislike, and then inappropriate attention, and then the seeds of the affliction still being within the continuum of their mind. As long as those come together, the afflictions are going to arise. When you see something beautiful and attractive that you like, and you are looking at it with inappropriate attention, you are almost automatically going to feel desire. When you see something that is unattractive, displeasing, that you don't like, and you look at it with inappropriate attention, then you are going to feel hatred or aversion and potentially act out of anger. And particularly with anger, we just don't have control, because once that cycle of anger gets going, it's hard to stop. And most people don't even think, I should try to stop it. In fact, what they think is they need to act it out. They think they're justified. They think that it's right, that they're on the right. Or if they're not in the right, they don't care. They want it anyways. And so they act out of their anger. They don't have a lot of control over what's happening. They just fly off and do something harmful. Or maybe someone is compelled by hunger, or by some other strong desire that they can't resist, addiction or something like that. You know, they might be impelled to action just because of the force of their cravings. They don't feel that they have any other choice because they're not in control of themselves. They're under the control of the afflictions. These conditions are making them act in ways. So they don't, there's no agency. There's nothing actually there that you can really say they're at fault, because there's so many conditions that put them there that they can't resist. They haven't been equipped, or they haven't been taught how to resist these problems. So people don't generally think, I think I'm going to get angry today. Today's a good day to get angry. As it says here, though people don't think I'll get angry, the commonplace angers them. Though they don't think I shall arouse it, their fury still arises. So it's not like people aren't planning, I'm going to have a temper tantrum today. I mean, maybe some people do, but it's generally not what's going to happen. It's the commonplace things happen because they don't have control of their minds, then they get angry and they act in ways that harm other people. They don't think I'm going to make my anger occur, but it comes up anyways. All the offenses that there are, all manifold misdeeds, occur because of their conditions. They have no self-control. So the people who are acting just don't have control over themselves. You get caught up, and then it's hard to resist once that cycle of the afflictions and craving and begins. It's hard to resist it, and then you're going to do something that's going to cause harm. You may know in the back of your mind that this is bad, but you do it anyways, because you're caught up in that cycle. And so that's why all of the wrongs that people commit, all of the misdeeds are because of these conditions. And so when we understand that, and someone acting, performing a misdeed that harms us directly, you understand that they're not in control, then you can feel like it's like there's not some person there who's really, 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 really in control. So there's nothing to get angry at. And the assembly of conditions has no thought I'll produce, nor does what it produces have the thought I'll be produced. So what this is saying, here we're getting kind of into logic, a little bit of logic and philosophy here. The assembly of conditions, so if other people, the people who are harming you, are acting because of conditions, then are the conditions at fault? Well, what are those conditions? You've got some object that they're focused on. That doesn't have any control of, not doesn't thinking I'm going to make them angry. You've got the seeds of the afflictions within them, those aren't thinking I'm going to make them angry. They're just bad habits of mind, essentially. And you've got the inappropriate attention. That's not thinking anything. That's just, again, a bad habit of looking at things in wrong ways. All of these different conditions that come together to produce anger, none of them individually is thinking, let's make some anger today. Let's look at things and make something angry. No one's thinking like that. None of them are thinking that because none of them are actually capable of thought on their own. Nor does what it produces have the thought all be produced, the anger or the offense. It's not saying, excuse me, inappropriate attention, object, and seeds of anger within the mind. Please produce me now. In fact, at that time, it doesn't exist because it hasn't yet been produced. So it's not thinking. There's no conscious agent. Either the being that we're looking at isn't really a conscious agent. The things that compel them to act are not a conscious agent. And so for that reason, what can you get angry at? So this is something where, to really kind of understand it, I think we have to look at ourselves and think about a time when you've lost your temper or you've gotten angry about something. And what is it you've known? I shouldn't get angry about this, but you have. Have you been able to control yourself? What exactly was going through your mind when you did that? Think about that for yourselves. I'm not saying do it right now. I'm saying just think in your own terms. There's probably been some situation in your life where you got angry and you realized later that your anger was unjustified. So, anger was unjustified. That's kind of what a tautology. All anger is pretty much unjustified. But is that a tautology? I'm getting my logical terms mixed up. At any rate, when you realize that you shouldn't have gotten angry, and you look back at it, and you say, why is it that I did get angry? Some misunderstanding, something went wrong, you misperceived a situation, you thought you wanted something or thought you didn't want something and you were angry about that. So it's when we have that misunderstanding, that's when we can have anger. When we have wisdom, we might not like the situation that we're in, but we don't necessarily get angry about it when there's wisdom involved. That's when we're not seeing it clearly. So we can see for ourselves that the conditions that make us get angry, you might have thought to yourself even before you got angry, I really shouldn't get angry here. But then you do. So what is that? So look at yourself to see how it works in your own mind. And I think you'll probably see that sometimes you just get angry and you can't help yourself. That other... it's got too little traffic. I don't know if this happens. That other driver cut you off. This is better in a bigger city. What can I say in Maine? It's too nice here. They cut you off in this line at the grocery store, you know, whatever, I don't know. Whatever it is that kind of ticked you off. Why is it that you got angry at that? When in fact, you know, what's going on in your own mind that makes you act in a certain way? When you've done something stupid, another way of looking at it, when you've done something that's harmed another being, because none of us are perfect, we've all done things that have caused harm to other beings. When you have done that, what made you act? And was it like something that you really had control over? How much control did you actually have? If you had had enough intelligence and progeny, yes, you could have had control, but frankly, most people lack the progeny to be able to do it. If otherwise, we'd see a lot more people doing virtue all the time and a lot fewer people doing so many negative activities. So that's the... That's the basic meditation on the teaching that the other sentient being does not have any control because they're controlled by the afflictions. Now, after this, we come to kind of the most difficult verses in the chapter, philosophically. So what we're kind of talking about there is the other person isn't really in control. There's not like a self of that other person in control. But there are other philosophies, non-Buddhist schools in India, who said there is a real self. Sentient beings do have a real self, and it is in control. And therefore, you might think that it's therefore logical to get angry at that self. To put it in kind of terms that would be more familiar for people from our society. It's like, if you say, okay, in Christianity, we say that people have a soul. They say that people have a soul. Because they have a soul, therefore they can have agency. There's a real thing that's them that's in control and permanent and true, and it's really there. Because there's that thing, then we can get, then they're not completely controlled by conditions because there's a self, a soul, and we can get angry at them. That's kind of an analogy for the logic here. So Shantideva then goes, and it's a course of five verses that just, I'm looking at the wrong section in my texts. Yes, five verses. So this starts in the next stanza, which reads, "The primal nature that they claim and self that they imagine do not arise, do not think I will come to be and arise intentionally. Without arising, they don't exist. What then would want to arise? Always distracted by an object, it also would never cease." Okay. So, Shantideva, if we go back, I didn't talk about this yet today. We talked about this 2 years ago, so we need a little refresher on the situation of when Shantideva was teaching this. He taught this at Nalanda University. They're trying to embarrass him and kick him out, so they erected a huge throne and said, please give a teaching. And sit on this throne and give a teaching, and this is the teaching that he gave. So his audience was a group of like 10,000, well, I don't know how many thousands of monks who were all very well educated in Buddhist and non-Buddhist philosophies. So if he just uses a couple key words, everyone knows the argument, and they've studied it, they've studied all the logic, so you can say, so he could just say this, and they'd all think, oh yeah, that's the argument about the Samkhya school. They have the primal nature of Prakriti, and they have the self or the Purusha, and yes, there are the 23 different manifestations and so forth, and yeah, they would be able to understand the nature of the whole thing. But we don't have that background, so that's why we have to. That's why it sounds so odd. The primal nature that they claim. So they, in this verse, means the Samkhya school of Buddhist philosophy. It's kind of a Hindu school. It's one of the oldest schools. There is a sage named Kapila, who lived probably a couple centuries before the Buddha, as far as we can tell. There's lots of dispute about Indian dates. And this philosophy developed over time, and they and it became the basis. It was the Samkhya school was a very influential school in ancient India, and it still continues to this day. In fact, in our just down the street from our monastery in Sarnath, outside of Varanasi, there is a Samkhya temple. So there's still Samkhya teachers around. And the Samkhya tradition also, that became the tradition of the yoga school, right? So particularly the Patanjali yoga. And when you read, like if you read Iyengar, you'll read lots of stuff that's very closely related to the Samkhya philosophy. So they say that there's a primary nature that has three basic, or three different constituents. It's got the sattva, rajas, and guna. Sattva, Rajas, and Tamas, the three guna, triguna, these three natures. And they're kind of, when they're in balance, then it's the primal nature. When they're out of balance, then it manifests in various different ways. And they say that they're essentially 23 different ways. It's kind of a complicated way of talking about how we have perceptions in this lifetime. And then what perceives all of those manifestations of the primal nature is a self. The Purusha, they call it in Sanskrit, Purusha. So it's a conscious self, and it's said to be permanent. Both it and the primal nature are said to be permanent, unchanging, eternal, and in control. So this is what Shantideva is reasserting here. The primal nature they assert, or the primal nature that they claim, and the self they imagine, do not think I will come to be and arise intentionally. So the primal nature doesn't have a thought, I'm going to arise, because the primal nature is not conscious. It is kind of, it's not, the self is conscious, the primal nature is not. So it doesn't have any thought that I'm going to arise. And even if it did, it's permanent. So how can it arise? If it's already there, why would it think I'm going to arise and come to be? Because it's already there if it is permanent. The self also is permanent, so it doesn't need to have any thought, I will come to be, because it's already there. If it doesn't exist, then, and thinks I'm going to come to be, then it's impermanent, which contradicts their idea. So they can't have an intentional thought. That's the point here, that there's that neither the primal nature nor the self can be an intentional being that would act to harm you. Without arising, they don't exist. What then would want to arise? So if you say that they can't arise because they'd then be impermanent, well, if they don't arise, then there's nothing there. Because how can something exist if it doesn't arise first? Right? If you're going to have a flower, it has to grow. That means it arises, and same with a self and so forth. So if it doesn't exist, then if it didn't arise, it wouldn't exist, and then there would be nothing to want to arise. So nothing that could be an agent that could harm you, and always distracted by an object, it also would never cease. So this primal nature would, or the self would always, it's said to be permanent and always enjoy the 23, or consume the 23 different manifestations. And if it's permanent, then it has to be never changing. Otherwise, it's changing and impermanent. You can either be changing and impermanent, or you can be permanent, and which means not changing. So it would always be observing that object, and it would always be distracted by that, and it would never cease because it's permanent. So that also couldn't be a self that would actually cause any harm. So this is kind of a basic description of this Samkhya school. There's a lot more. This is actually kind of the longest portion of the commentary, and I don't want to go into too much detail. The basic point is saying, Shantideva is saying that you can't have a permanent conscious soul that would be a self to get angry at. That doesn't make any sense.